Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing with Chapter 6 from Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks, Archangel Ridge, Mount Foraker, 1975. In Part 1, we got organized, we launched, and we hiked in with Burl Mersch's horses and were dropped off at the head of Caribou Valley. Close to Foraker, but we had to cross a pass we had never even seen. Wolf Pass. No one had ever crossed the 6,250-foot pass between Caribou Valley and the Foraker Glacier. We had never even seen it. We stared hard at the map and tried to convince ourselves that we could cross it, but doubt always tugged at the corners of our conversations. I looked at our pile of gear deep in Caribou Valley and understood our commitment to this place. The expedition's success depended on crossing the pass. We would either cross the pass and walk smugly to the base of the Archangel, or we would retreat in defeat. On June 20, clouds and rain still filled the valley, but we went to work immediately. There was too much at stake to allow a rest. Brad, Charlie, and Stu stayed in camp to sort gear. Dave, Barb, and I packed big loads up into the clouds, but stalled out at 5,500 feet. What little we saw convinced us that the final slope to the pass was avalanche-prone, and we listened to avalanches crashing down on both sides of the valley. We decided to attempt the final climb to the pass when we had better visibility. At day's end, we were even more committed. It rained hard during the night, but the clouds lifted in the morning, and we tried again. When we congregated at our 5,500-foot cache, we saw the final slope to the pass. Brad verbalized our concerns. "It looks like an avalanche trap for sure. Look at all the debris." Dave added, "Look, some of the avalanche debris came from the left, some from the right, and some from the slope itself. There's no way around the problem." Charlie quipped, "Oh great, just what we need, a do-or-die death test before we even see the Archangel." Barb chimed in, "It appears that's just what we have." Stu put his binoculars down and interrupted, "Calm down, kids. I can see wolf tracks going over the pass." We looked at the clear line of wolf tracks going up to the pass. They did not come back down. The wolf clearly made it over the pass, and I said, "If Wolf was brave enough to cross, then we are too. Wolf Pass is our first test, and we have to start thinking like a wild animal. Now, here's how we're going to do it. There's no point in roping up. The snow is soft and not that steep. If an avalanche buries someone, their best chance of survival is to have unburied companions to dig them out. We'll go one at a time from the safety of the last good rock outcrop. When each person reaches the safety of the upper rocks, they wait and watch the others. It will be slow, but as safe as we can make it. I'll go first. Wolf Pass, here we come." After two nervous hours, we all reached the rocks above the avalanche hazard. I said, "It worked like a charm. Now, up to the pass. The clouds are breaking." As we approached the pass, we instinctively sped up because we all knew that this was our first real chance for a view of the Archangel. Approaching the pass, we ran pell-mell with giant strides across the scree until the entire peak came into view. There was no doubt this time. There it was. Foraker's north face socked our senses skyward. Rising directly from glacier to summit, in the center of the face was the ridge that we had come to climb. We staggered for support and sank to the scree. Mouths hanging open, we stared in awe. As we sat on Wolf Pass, we wavered between ferocity and fear. It was fantastic. Such moments are an answer to the question, why climb? Foraker is an answer, not a question. Theodore Roosevelt concurred when he said, Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die, and none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life. Both life and death are part of the same great adventure. As we descended toward the Foraker Glacier and our great adventure, we chose life. We found life in a beautiful meadow at 5,500 feet just above the Foraker Glacier. 2.5 miles from the Archangel, we added our life to the meadows. The view from Glacier Meadow was even more inspiring. As we ferried loads over Wolf Pass from Caribou Valley to Glacier Meadow, the views played with us. Sometimes they were stark and harsh. Sometimes translucence veiled the peak. Sometimes it all vanished, but this didn't matter. Having seen the Archangel once, we knew. We set fear aside in our multiple crossings of the avalanche trap, practiced ferocity, and transformed intellectual commitment into emotional commitment. The two are not the same. We had yet to realize physical commitment. I paused on Wolf Pass with the last load and lingered for a long look back at Caribou Valley. We would not go back through Caribou Valley. For our return, we would hike down the Foraker Glacier. I would never see Caribou Valley again. It had served us well, but my boot arrows pointed forward. As I descended to Glacier Meadow, a mystic view of Foraker filtered through a swirling mist. The upper peak was clear. Touching commitment. On June 25, Stu woke us with his beautiful alarm clock yodel. Cuckoo, yodel-a-dle-yo, cuckoo. I poked my head into the sun and sang my calypso encouragement. Brothers? Sister? You hear me calling at the crack o' dawn? Jump up, brothers, come and face the morn. Forget your aching from the day before, 'cause today we gonna do that and more. We were finally in residence at Glacier Meadow and frolicked in our privileged position. The view of the Archangel from here was overpowering. We studied it carefully and noticed several features that we had not seen in Washburn's photo. We had a better perspective from Glacier Meadow than Washburn had looking straight at the ridge from the airplane. The Archangel's reality was much more powerful than any two-dimensional image. People usually view photographs by looking down or straight ahead. We viewed the three-dimensional Archangel by craning our necks and squinting steeply up. I have learned to view photographs of great peaks by letting them expand to fill the horizons of my mind, then holding the photograph over my head and looking up at it. After breakfast, we dropped onto the Foraker Glacier and carried loads toward the base of the Archangel. Crevasses were not the only hazard on this glacier. We had trouble crossing a large stream that rushed through a deep ice-walled groove on the glacier's surface. As I stood dangerously close to the edge of the ice-water barrier, contemplating a long leap across, I remembered that such streams eventually disappear into large holes in the glacier. I visualized an unchecked fall into this stream. The frigid stream would carry me along screaming as I clawed ineffectively at the hard ice with my freezing fingernails. Just before I lost consciousness from the cold, the river would drop me to my desperate doom in the deep, dark, dank hole. Visualization complete, we backtracked down the glacier for 500 yards to where the stream disappeared into its hellhole and got around Foraker's River of No Return. When we reached 6,300 feet directly under the Archangel, I surveyed the undulating, slush-covered glacier. Obeying an instinct, we dropped our loads on a hump rather than in a trough. This later proved to be a prophetic choice. Thin clouds in the glacial basin acted as a greenhouse roof that blocked our view of the Archangel. As we strained in vain for views, steam bath temperatures extracted buckets of our sweat. June 26 was gloriously clear, and we returned singing to the base of the Archangel. We didn't have a name for our new camp, but something would soon occur to inspire a name. Under clear skies, we stared up the Archangel, and the mountain towering over us was all-consuming. 4 Acres' 17,400-foot summit was over 11,000 feet above us and just over 3 map miles away. From where we stood, our route rose at an average angle of 35 degrees. We would climb on snow and ice the entire time. Our minds could not hold the Archangel all at once. For the umpteenth time, we broke Archangel into more manageable pieces. These mental rehearsals focused us on details and prepared us for the climb. First, we would zoom up a glacial slope exposed to avalanches from a small hanging glacier. We named this slope the Apron and hoped the Queen would not flick us from her apron like crumbs. At the first opportunity, we would move left to get out from under the hanging glacier, then climb a long, smooth snow slope to a broken area where we hoped to pitch Camp 1. We called the smooth slope the Target. It contained a curious snow hollow that we called the Bullet. We hoped that we were not targets. The Archangel's classic aspect began above Camp 1. We would climb a graceful ridge to a suspended point we named the Apex. Beyond the apex, we would carefully traverse an elegant knife-edge ridge that we had not seen in Washburn's photo. We named this the Angel's Way, and on first sight, Dave insisted that it was his lead. Camp 2 would be beyond the Angel's Way. Above Camp 2, the ridge rose directly toward the summit. So would we. Camp 3 would be in a wide spot in the ridge at 11,800 feet. The upper part of the mountain was easier, and we hoped to go to the summit from Camp 3. I insisted that the last 1,000 feet were my lead. The last pitch was a privilege, not a test. I sensed something special up there and wanted to conduct the last chorus. On June 27, Brad, Dave, and I started up the route while Stu, Barb, and Charlie ferried more loads from Glacier Meadow. Under clear skies, we sprinted up the apron and didn't stop until we were out of danger at the base of the Bullet. We climbed a thin layer of snow over ice on the Bullet's left edge, then plowed laboriously through deep snow up to the Target. Avalanche fear drew our minds tight. The slightest crack or crunch anywhere in the valley froze us in our tracks as we peered around, trying to understand our new environment. To climb the Archangel, we had to overcome its physical obstacles and our fear. As we faced our first real fear of death, our physical commitment began. It is very different from intellectual or emotional commitment. I didn't understand at the time, but my commitment increased in powerful stages. Fear easily shatters physical commitment, and great peaks like Four Acre easily create fear. Physical commitment backed up by stable intellectual commitment and deep emotional commitment extends your breaking point. Great peaks require physical strength and ability, but a solid commitment triangle is also essential. Commitment and strength are the fundamental components of a great climb. Add positive, forward-accelerating summit momentum, and you have a formula for success. As we crept onto the Archangel, our physical commitment was not yet complete, but our consuming question was if, not why. In asking why, you are preparing for failure. Any adversity or fear is likely to send you scuttling for safety. Climbers on expeditions rarely debate why. They ask if. They ask, can we make it? Many climbers cannot articulate answers, but they intrinsically understand why they are climbing. On the Target, the Archangel hung above us like an infinite answer to the question why. 4 Acre was an answer. Our commitment and strength were the questions. Above the Target, we came to a largely filled-in barrier crevasse that went completely across the slope. The lower lip was 30 feet below the upper lip. Dave took one look at the near-vertical challenge and said, "I'll lead it." Dave prepared to lead while Brad and I buried a snow fluke deep in the snow for an anchor in the exposed spot. We were all nervous. Something did not feel right. Brad and I belayed while Dave moved steadily up the wall. Without warning, a sharp crack rifled across the slope as Brad and I felt a sickening drop. As the whole slope shifted, Brad and I looked at each other with mile-wide eyes, thinking that we were goners. Expecting to plummet into the abyss in the next second, our fear shot to new levels. Could our commitment contain it? The giant settling crack relieved the slope's tension, and in the next second, we were still firmly anchored to the Archangel. I stammered at Brad, "Did you hear that?" His still wide eyes twitched as he replies, "Does a wild bear poop in the woods?" I relaxed enough to smile and say, "Yeah, but he almost hit us." Dave's lead still absorbed him, and Brad hollered up, "Dave, did you feel that shockwave?" He replied, "What? No, this ain't no beach. Don't talk to me about waves." Apparently, Dave was fine, so I just yelled, "Keep climbing!" As our breathing returned to normal, Brad said, "I guess we call this the shockwave wall." Safely above our shocking wall, we continued up to a tiny platform at 8,500 feet where we would place Camp 1. The ridge above looked exciting, but after a while we averted our eyes. It was still too much to hold all at once, so we sat facing the valley to eat lunch. A huge avalanche re-triggered our jumpy nerves as it roared down the basin east of the Archangel and swept across the upper part of the 4-acre glacier. Its billowing snow cloud hung in the air as we packed up to get the hell out of there. We had seen enough for one day. As we descended the soggy snow, we decided to climb at night when the snow would be harder. Killer Storm. On June 28, a beautiful mountain sheep with a full curl watched Stu, Barb, and Charlie collect the last loads at Glacier Meadow. How old was he? He lived here. What did he know that we did not? Probably a lot. I wish that we had his knowledge of the Queen's environment. Dave, Brad, and Stu spread out their sleeping bags to air in the sun as we prepared for our night climb. After noon, evil mackerel clouds raked the sky, and we watched in primitive fascination as they sent friendly air scurrying elsewhere. We didn't want to believe it, but it was clear that a bad storm was coming. As Barb and I pitched our tent, Barb looked up and said, "It's the Queen's bandera de combat." I replied, "Let's get the tent nailed down." A sinister wind sprang from an unseen wildness backwater, and while Barb held the flapping tent, I looked up and saw one of the drying sleeping bags rolling across the glacier. I almost laughed as I watched Dave take several spastic steps in the deep snow trying to retrieve it. Suddenly, the wind became a serious gale, and all three sleeping bags blew away. In the next instant, Dave, Brad, Stu, and I sprinted after them. The loss of a single sleeping bag would be serious, and the loss of three would be devastating. Dave was the closest, but he lurched into a slush hole, and the bag scooted farther ahead as he struggled in the hole. Stu passed Dave, poured it on, and did a flying leap onto one bag. Brad and I beelined for the other two. We sank into the soggy snow with each step, and our high-energy sprint did not produce much speed. When I realized that the bags were moving faster than me, I visualized my old track workouts and thought, "You used to be good at this, Roach. Hit it!" I drove hard with my arms, summoned rage, and transferred the energy to my legs. I doubled my speed, and Brad moved into my tracks. This was not a race for glory. This was a race for survival. When I looked up, I saw the sleeping bags sailing freely away in the air. the two precious fluffs twisted, dove, then rose like dueling kites until they disappeared from our sight over a ridge on the glacier. Brad gasped, "Crevasse!" I did not break stride, pointed forward, and hollered, "Sleeping bag!" Rage had me, and I held my driving pace, thinking, "Bloody hell, Denali swiped Mike's pack. Foraker is not going to steal our sleeping bags." I pounded along toward the last seen point on the ridge. Our last chance was if the bags stopped in the lee of the ridge. I commanded the wind to stop the bags as I charged up to the ridge with screaming lungs. If the bags stopped for 60 seconds, we would have them. I crested the ridge, took one look, and kept driving. Both bags teetered inches from a large glacial lake. The slightest puff of wind would send them into the water. There was slush everywhere, and it was not exactly clear where the edge of the lake was, but I kept slogging through the slush. The Queen would not steal our beds. Brad stopped and watched intently as I slugged through knee-deep slush to the first bag and on to the second. I had them! For the first time since leaving the tent, I stopped and looked back. Chest heaving, Brad stood at the edge of the slush. 100 yards away, Stu, still clutching the first bag, stood on the ridge like a silent sentinel. The three of us sucked air for a gravid minute. Finally, in a voice that carried clearly, Stu said, "There's more than one way to lose it up here, isn't there?" We trudged pensively back to the tents, clutching our windfall prizes. Our 600-yard Keystone Cops chase was just the beginning of Killer Storm. Back at the tents, we had other problems. The wind increased in ferocity faster than we could prepare for it. We threw everything into our three tents and tried to hunker down. Dave, Brad, and Stu crawled into our McKinley tent with its center pole. Charlie was by himself in our Frostline Kodiak tent, a reliable U-frame design. Barb and I were in our larger Frostline Trail Ridge tent. Barb and I managed a makeshift dinner, then scrunched into our soggy sleeping bags for an uncertain night as gray gloom grabbed camp. There was no time for mind music since the wind was in command, and its intentions were clear. It wanted our gear, then it wanted us. At 11 p.m., Charlie screamed, "Help! Tent going down!" I sat up and roared, "I'm coming out! Hang on!" While I frantically pulled my boots on, Charlie kept screaming, "Hurry! Tent's taken off! I can't hold much longer!" All his equipment was in the Kodiak, and its loss would be a major disaster. As Charlie slowly lost his grip on the tent coomsail, he gave ground down the glacier. I bolted out of the trail ridge, ran after him, and just in time did a painful belly flop onto the Kodiak. In a knee-barking grounding, the two of us clung to the wildly flapping nylon. Now what? Before I could make any rational assessment, Charlie howled through the wind, "This wasn't in the brochure!" Seizing the moment, I bellowed back, "You should have read the fine print instead of just looking at the pictures." Killer Storm was a hypothermia special. Horizontal, near-freezing, wind-driven sleet and rain stung my eyes as I squinted through the tempest. I saw bare ice and realized that the snow we had pitched the tents on was rapidly melting from the wind and rain. The Kodiak had collapsed when the glacier melted away under it. We had a big problem, since the same thing would happen to the other tents in a few more minutes. We could not repitch the tents on the slush-covered ice, and could not dig a cave in the slush or the ice. We would die in Killer Storm without shelter. We had to save the tents. Charlie and I wadded up the Kodiak with all its contents and crammed the soggy mess into the trail ridge on top of Barb, who was stuffing sleeping bags to keep them dry. I told Charlie to dive into the trail ridge, then stomped over to the McKinley tent. It was in bad shape. Stu had lowered the tent by taking a section out of the center pole, but the tent was not going to make it. I explained the melting problem, told Dave, Brad, and Stu to do what they could for their tent, and that I would try to save the Trail Ridge Kodiak mess. Big rocks anchored the Trail Ridge guy lines, but the melting snow loosened the guy lines. Then the wind sawed the lines against the rocks until they broke. If all the snow melted and all the guy lines broke, both tents would blow away on the slippery ice and take us with them. I found even more rocks and piled them onto the fly. Frozen, I crawled into the Trail Ridge for relief. Charlie and Barb had organized the Kodiak clutter, and there was just room for three of us. The tent volume shrank as violent wind blasts pushed the top of the tent toward the floor. We cursed the volume loss, but knew that, like the proverbial reed, our tent had to bend before the wind. I peered out the tiny tent vent and watched the saga over at the McKinley tent. In spite of Brad's best efforts, the McKinley went down at midnight. For a while, Dave, Brad, and Stu just huddled inside the collapsed tent, holding flapping cloth around them as water soaked into their sleeping bags and their heat ebbed away. One by one, they made dashes for the Trail Ridge in the depths of the northern night. Stu, the last to leave, piled rocks on the now flat tent to keep it from taking off. When Stu arrived in the Trail Ridge, he was shivering uncontrollably. Where there had been marginal room for three, there was now even less room for all six of us. We had no choice. As the snow around the tent disappeared, we shared our communal body heat. The Trail Ridge was our last hope, and in the dawn hours I made another trip outside to do what I could. I piled more rocks on the sagging fly. This preserved some of the snow under the tent and provided an arched structure under the floor that held the tent in place. Back inside, our body heat slowly melted this anchoring snow dome, and I dimly realized that Killer Storm had schnocked us. If the storm wanted us, it had us. Which would go first, the storm or us? We huddled together and waited for the answer. The new day brought increased heat and light, and we reached an uneasy equilibrium as Killer Storm blew on into June 29. Every 2 hours, I orbited the Trail Ridge to secure it as it sank. On one orbit, I heard a new sound. It was the sound of rushing water. My heart skipped a beat. Was a new river of no return coming through our camp? Killer Storm had completely changed the glacier's appearance. The entire snow cover had melted, leaving ugly ice littered with rocks and gravel, and sure enough, new rivers formed. I took a short hike to see if we were in jeopardy, found one river in a trough north of camp, and a larger river south of camp between us and the Archangel. Our camp was on a hump between these two rivers and seemed to be out of danger for the moment. I praised my earlier instinct that left the initial loads on this hump rather than in a trough. Energy sink. We received our answer afternoon on June 29 when Killer Storm left as rapidly as it came. One by one we unfolded from the Trail Ridge and blinked at the clouds scudding away from the Archangel. Killer Storm left us drained, and in our weakened condition the storm's speed and ferocity were hard to grasp, like the Archangel. For now, the desolate landscape, our ravaged camp, and parched throats were life enough. The dominating Archangel overhead didn't just mock us, it leered at us. We had no thoughts of climbing. How could we climb this mountain if we couldn't even make a decent base camp? We did what we could for the ravaged camp and prepared a hot meal. That night we tried to find sleep in our wet sleeping bags. Bright sun greeted us on June 30. We stumbled around all day in a stupor trying to make order out of chaos. We spread our soaked sleeping bags to dry and tied them in this time. We spent hours trying to repair and repitch the tents on the ice. Afternoon, Dave threw the McKinley tent to the ice in disgust and said, "Even if we repair this mess, it's going to end up flat the next time, too. This is a pancake tent. I don't want anything more to do with it." The same activities consumed July 1. Our tent platforms and the ice melted out as fast as we chopped them, and large puddles littered the camp. At midday, Stu said, "This camp is an energy sink. We're spending all our time just surviving. There's no time or energy left to climb." I replied, "Brilliant! That's the name of this camp, Energy Sink. Our new goal is to get the hell out of sink camp. Nothing can be worse than the energy sink. Let's see if we can escape up the mountain." Charlie and I built a rock bridge across the now raging river between us and the bottom of the Archangel. What hellhole this new river of no return dropped into, we knew not. The Archangel was getting harder, not easier. Our resolve to get the hell out of sink camp stiffened, but we still did not have physical commitment to the Archangel. We sacked out in the evening, got up at 11 p.m., ate dinner, slunk from the tents like thieves in the night, and started up. At least we would try. All six of us carried loads through the night to our small camp, one cache, as the night light and residual storm fatigue put fear in a fog. When pink sunlight kissed the upper peak at 3 a.m., we climbed toward it in a trance. When we reached our still-shadowed cache at 4 a.m., I asked Barb how she felt. She blurted out, "Slow, weak, inferior, and cold." I helped her take her pack off and replied, "Yeah, me too. I would add fear to my list, though. Dream climb is the toughest thing we've ever done together. Get your extra clothes on, then let's eat some breakfast. I've got a thermos full of hot chocolate, and the sun will be here in an hour." As we sat munching a cold breakfast and sipping hot chocolate, we watched the sun creep down the ridge toward us. The upper Archangel's sunny day started many hours before ours. The Archangel's life force was slow but steady. Its movement warmed our minds but not our bodies. Brad watched the spectacle and said, "We should name this camp Eiger View." Everybody agreed. We wanted to leave our damaged pancake tent in sink camp and use igloos on the mountain. So Brad, Stu, and Barb remained at Eiger View to build an igloo, while Dave, Charlie, and I led on up the Virgin Ridge toward the sun. A kaleidoscope of curve, color, line, rhythm, angle, and texture graced our beautiful dawn climb. When the sun found us, my mind music started playing again. As Dave led the final slope up to the apex at 9,500 feet, Charlie and I kept peppering him with, "What's it like? What's it like? What can you see? Hurry!" When Dave pulled onto the apex, he leaned silently on his axe for 30 seconds before he said anything. Then, in a subdued voice, he said, "Whoa, I've never seen anything like this. Come on up, guys. You're in for a treat." When Charlie and I reached the apex, Charlie breathed, "Heavy, heavy duty." I knew instantly that this was the most beautiful position I had ever experienced, and added a soft yowza. We stood breathlessly on the end of a narrow knife-edge ridge. There was air everywhere, and I felt like I was suspended from a skyhook. There were abysses behind me, the way we had come, on the other side of the ridge and out toward the glacier. The only connection to Earth and reality that we could focus on was along the ridge toward the Queen's summit. The knife danced away from us, rising gently in a series of graceful curves and cusps. The ridge was both terrifying and terrific. This was the Angel's way to the Queen's Archangel. We were the first people to see this view and the first to contemplate climbing this delicate ridge. I caressed the virgin snow with my bare hand and smiled at the angel. This is why we had come so far. As I looked around, I realized that the apex was the route's pivotal point, and traversing the angel's way would attach us to the upper mountain. Satiated with splendor, we descended before the day's heat triggered avalanches, but knew that we could escape farther up the mountain. Stay tuned for the conclusion, part 3, of this exciting adventure on the Archangel Ridge of Mount Foraker in 1975.